Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Elaine's. My name is Jeffrey Higgins. It's my wife Cynthia's restaurant. It's good to see you here, and thank you all for eating. It's helping us keep the lights on. We've turned this into a literary salon. I've interviewed over 100 authors since we've first opened, and we host writing groups and libraries, and Barnes & Noble comes in and supports some book sales, and so we're happy to be a part of the literary community in the D.C. metro area. I'm excited about today's interview. Army brat, veteran, world traveler, foreign student, international trade, and government lawyer are all titles applicable to author Timothy Trainor. Born in Japan to a career soldier, he had a nomadic upbringing. He too served in the Army from 72 to 75. After his term of enlistment in the Army that included foreign language training and a course in interrogation, I want to hear more about that, Tim, by the way. He earned multiple degrees that included 16 months studying in Japan. His legal career involved federal government and private sector legal positions in Washington, D.C. He worked at multiple agencies and traveled extensively as a member of interagency negotiating delegations. As a government attorney, he represented the U.S. at meetings of the World Intellectual Property Organization in Geneva. Working in the private sector, he testified before the U.S. congressional committees on several occasions. With an emphasis on intellectual property enforcement to combat trade in illicit goods, he worked with Interpol, the U.N.'s Economic Commission for Europe, and other international organizations. From 2000 to 2020, Mr. Trainor was a committee member and a cleared private sector industry advisor to the U.S. Department of Commerce and the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. Mr. Trainor has authored numerous professional articles and books on intellectual property issues. His novels include The China Factor, The China Connection, and The Pendulum Over the Pacific. His nonfiction book, The Fortunate Son, is a collection of recollections from Vietnam veterans who served with Mr. Trainor's father in a rifle company in 1968 and 1969. So please welcome Tim Trainor.
So it's good to have you here.
Why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about your book? Give us just a little short synopsis or back jacket copy.
The China Factor is inspired by a lot of the work I did with China or in China with the U.S. government. And the tensions, the conflicts between U.S., China, as far as economic competition with global trade. And underneath all of that, I found out that, you know, there are a lot of possibilities here for fiction because the tensions and the conflicts that occur between governments lead to potential situations for the individuals who are involved in the actual negotiating between governments. So having been on international delegations for the U.S. government, I thought, well, let's explore that a little bit and see what kind of things could potentially happen. What kind of issues can come up that create even more tension? And certainly the characters are important because they're the ones that are involved in all these things in the scenes and just the interpersonal relationships that might occur and the conflict even between the individuals themselves. So, first you start with your own personal experience and then you delve into, well, how can we play around with that stuff and create some interesting situations?
So you did a lot of work with like proper intellectual property theft while you were doing your real world work.
Yes.
Were the ideas of novels churning, or was it something that came later?
It came later because when you're involved in that kind of work day to day and traveling, I mean, you're consumed by the work itself and the travel. And so it wasn't until after actually I retired that the China Connection, which is the one prior to the China Factor, really the idea came to mind. And then it's continuing to play with that whole idea and continue to write about it.
And, you know, one of the worst questions people can ask an author is like, where do your ideas come from? But I'm always interested, like, when the actual idea starts to generate. Was there a moment or something that set off this idea that you later developed?
Well, once I start thinking that I want to write a story, then the actual details start to come to mind, and we talked about this prior. For me, being on a treadmill, I don't know why, despite how boring that sounds, funny things start to pop into my head when I'm doing absolutely nothing. And then the order of things start to happen with me when I'm actually working out. So working out is actually part of the writing process for me. I try to write before the workouts and after the workouts because once I've done the workout, usually if I'm in the middle of a scene or if I've got a bit of a block, for some reason, working out helps me. It may sound strange to some people, but that's just one of those things for me.
I think there's something magical about story development, right? And in creativity in general. But I think everyone experiences that where you're in the shower or you're doing something where you're letting your mind wander.
Yeah.
I mean, there've been people who've actually harnessed that, right? Was it Tesla or so? Some inventor would sit there with like lead balls in his hand and a tray beneath him, so that he would get into that twilight moment right before sleep when his brain would be active.
Yeah.
Do you ever do that, where you like think of plot problems or something before you go to sleep and wake up with the answer?
It's not so much. Well, there are scenes that pop up, but they're always the wrong time, right? If you're in the shower, you don't have something to write with or to record. You don't have your phone. And the same thing on a treadmill. You don't have everything right there at your fingertips when that happens. And you say, I hope I can remember all this stuff when I get back in front of my computer to start typing. And of course, usually by the time that happens, you've already lost a little bit of that. You're fighting to grab it back. And it's sometimes very difficult to do. As long as you get the essentials, though, it's good.
With the risk of sounding like a real writer nerd, I can tell you I have Aqua Notes. It's the thing you stick under the wall of your shower with a pencil. I swear to God, because I got tired of running naked through the house trying to write things down before I forgot them.
Might be something I have to buy, because it is absolutely true. I think, and I've listened to other writers, people who do this a lot more than I do, and they talk about the way things happen mentally. And I think that alone is an interesting thing. If you're writing fiction, the things that happen in my mind as trying to write fiction is totally different from everything else. I don't know why, but it just is.
So tell us a little bit about the plot, because you have there's both a personal with someone's job in jeopardy, right? And you're also looking at broader issues, like national issues. Tell us a little bit about that.
I always start with a broader issue, and in this particular case, the China factor, actually, I have to confess that what I thought was going to be the beginning now appears at like page 60-something, because, again, going back to the whole exercise thing, I thought I had the right beginning with a broad U.S.-China competition, looking for new markets and how to export. I thought that was okay. We've got that as the big thing. But then getting down to the detail, what was going to be the thing that creates the conflict, the tension between the characters? And that came to me actually after I'd written about 20-some pages, thought I was at the beginning, and realized one day while I was on the treadmill that I thought, no, the beginning is X. And so what you find at the beginning, which is the theft of confidential information, that is what came to me while I was on the treadmill and playing with that. And I'm hoping that for some people who might work for the U.S. Patent Trademark Office, they won't get too upset with me, because I certainly took advantage of my time working there and my knowledge of the agency and so on to play with that idea of theft of information. And partly the other part of that is how closely is information actually kept confidential? I mean, what are the security processes at the agency to ensure that all this information that comes into a government agency is secure? Because you have thousands of people working in an agency accessing the information. But who actually is checking and making sure that all that information is kept under lock and key?
Who is checking?
Well, that's a good question. Because going back, I mean, I recall that my time working there, I can say that in the 3.5 years or so that I worked in the policy office, I was never approached at any time to have my briefcase checked or anything when I left the office, ever. So it just kind of led to an idea that I could play with. And so that's kind of what I did here in the book.
How big a problem is intellectual property theft?
Intellectual property theft is one of the big international trade problems, and nobody can tell you how many billions. You know, there are estimates out there in the hundreds of billions of dollars, because it affects anything that one can make, because it's patents, it's trademarks, it's copyrights, trade secrets, and so on. And you can't put a number on it. I mean, when I worked at U.S. Customs, which predates Customs and Border Protection, there were always estimates flying around, but nobody knows. It's kind of like asking somebody, well, how much illicit drugs are being brought into the United States? It's a guess. It's a wild guess, because you only know what you catch. Right. And so otherwise, everything else is you're pulling numbers out of the air. And same thing with illicit trade. You're pulling numbers out of the air because you only know what you catch. And if you take U.S., European Union, Japan, which are the three predominant places where you can actually get statistics, the numbers are massive there. But then you go to Africa, South America, where, let's say, that the legal process or the enforcement process, much weaker, data collection, very different. You, who knows? And it's everything from $2 battery, AA battery, to things that may be thousands of dollars that are illicit products out there, not made to standards, can pose a health and safety risk. Think about medicine. I mean, we all know about possibility of counterfeit medicine. How about a tube of toothpaste? I mean, it's everything, but price ranges don't matter. It's whatever the guy who's making the illicit good can make a dollar from, right? Or a few pennies even. So it doesn't matter whether it's throw away razor blades, you can clean them up, repackage them, put them back in, sell them again. And it happens.
It seems like the copyright holder would notice, right, if their specific invention popped up. But it's part of the problem was, even if they see something that's similar, there's no way to really draw a direct line to show like the theft or to show that it was a trademark infringement.
Each part of this, because the patents are much more difficult because usually very technical. On the one hand, it's technical and harder, but on the other hand, because of that, sometimes it might be, I won't say easier, but you can detect it because it's missing something in the invention. Trademarks, it's a logo. You know, I'm looking at Zoom, for example, on the screen, and you say, okay, who's allowed to use Zoom for this kind of a product or this service? Maybe because it's more visible. Copyright these days has gotten extremely complicated because of software and so on. So every part of the intellectual property world is affected. And of course, trade secrets. Well, if you're forced to give away your trade secret in order to operate in the country, I won't name the country, though it might be named in the title of my book. But if you want to do business some places, sometimes you have to give up information, proprietary information that you don't want to give up. Maybe you should forego doing anything there. Because as soon as you give it up, who knows who's got access to it. So you know, this is the world of international business. It also creates a lot of potential for a lot of storylines, the characters that are involved, and so on. And it's a world that I would think a lot of people really aren't familiar with.
Is China the number one violator?
We've looked at China as the number one violator now for probably the last 30 years. You know, lots of resources, a lot of government resources, corporate resources going to try and tighten that. But the problem is, as long as companies want to do business in China, they have to understand that you take the risk of having your proprietary information stolen and your profits going down or being hurt because of it. So it's a risk that a company has to decide. Do we want to take that risk or not? I mean, it's not the government making that decision. It's a company that makes that decision. It's the managers, the CEOs, and so on. Somebody asked me in an interview once this years ago, when the U.S. car company started making parts in China, they said, well, why has it taken such a short time for the Chinese to knock it off? I said, well, when they're down the street, you could get access to their parts a lot quicker than if they're across the ocean. So the timeline between getting access and making that fake product, fake part, all of a sudden, it's a much shorter period.
So you mentioned a lot of people don't know much about this. So when you're writing like a thriller, would you consider it a thriller? Or,
you know, I don't know what to call my books because I don't think they fall neatly into a category. I think of geoeconomics, like geopolitics. They're not a straight out spy novel, but at the same time, I try to throw in some intrigue. The China Connection, I put in the mystery thriller crime category. I don't know that it's an espionage, but it's harder for me to categorize. I would say ask a few of the people who read the couple of the books and say, let them tell you, because I'm never sure. You know, it's a harder thing for me to answer.
Maybe a political thriller or political espionage.
Yeah, something like that.
So when you're teaching someone something new or bringing a fairly unknown subject to them, how do you balance like pacing and keeping the thrill of a book going while you're basically giving them a lot of information?
Yeah, that's a tough one for a writer, isn't it? And this is when I have to keep in mind my number one editor, shall we say, who will tell me whether I've got the right balance or not, and that would be my wife, because when I'm finally done with a write through and I've read it a couple of times, there's still that big test of, have I done anything that needs to be truly reworked or completely edited out? And she's probably the person that tells me where the balance is. And yeah, she's a very hard critic and editor. And, you know, she's actually helped me to write much tighter. I will say that. Because my very first novel that I wrote, she, I think, redlined about 200 pages. I was very verbose. So she did a very good job of reining me in. And so she's been good about that. And she's a, you know, just a big reader, an avid reader. And she has a good idea of what a novel should look like as a reader. And so, yeah, she's if I can get past her, then I can get to the next level of beta readers. But if I can't get past her, I know it's going nowhere.
A lot of writers will say they avoid like family and friends because they won't get an honest critique, right? Because people love you. But it's a real gift to have somebody who actually critiques your work and is honest with it. It's always tough to get criticism, especially at the beginning when you first start writing. And then there's an added level of it. It's somebody you're married to, right? Did you ever have like a certain amount of tension around that, or did it take you a while to get used to it, or walk us through?
Yeah, I think the first time it took a long time to get used to it. The first time, especially when there was more red than there was black, and then when you see page upon page, complete pages X'd out, you go, she's terrible at this, you know. It's like, I want to keep the scene, but she wants it out. She says, no, you don't need that scene. And I love that scene, you know. And so, yeah, at that point, it was a bit of a tense situation. But I think that there were a number of years between that first one and then the China Connection. So she was pretty good about that. Of course, I had it in mind about avoiding X'd out pages. So I was pretty careful myself. But then, you know, when we would talk about it, she had a good reason. She could always explain to me why she felt this or that wasn't necessary. And you start to trust, you know, that kind of input. And so for this last one, the China Factor, the newest one, we didn't really cut out pages. There were phrases here or inserts there, but literally no more than maybe about 2 or 3 pages in change of length, because I knew what might be coming if I didn't do it right. So
when you write now, do you write for her thinking like, what would she think about this as you write?
I don't know that I'd say that. I think when I'm writing now, I'm much more conscious of, am I writing as tightly as I can? I think that's really what the key is. That's one of the things she's kind of taught me is, be careful and don't put in things that you don't really need. And then later on, after I've read it a few times, even after I'm done with the first write through, and then I read and do my edits, once I give it to her, even she now has a process. She reads it the first time just as a reader. And if she likes it, she'll go back and then read it with more of an editor's eye and say to me, here's where I think you need to do a few things here and there. So, you know, between the two of us, we probably go through the manuscript, I don't know, 7, 8 times before it would ever see anybody else's eyes.
So you start off with like the information exchange, right, at the beginning of this, but then it's really about this woman who's been nominated for a State Department position, right? And whose story is this? Like, tell us about who, you have several main characters.
Well, Kelly is the woman in China Factory who's nominated for the State Department job. And what happens, of course, is there's a back history of her father being involved with some shady characters in China. She's Chinese American. And so he's been prosecuted. And there is that history that she has. It's pretty negative. And not to her, though. She's been cleared. But there's still misgivings by people in Congress about, well, do we give her a high-level State Department job, given that she is Chinese American? And there's that issue. And when there's this confidential information theft, she gets involved in that and with the FBI, and she actually helps him with the investigation. And here we go between there and one of the other characters from the previous book, Aaron, who's in Vietnam on a trip with his uncle. And the uncle just wants to go back and visit some places, but he also has an ulterior motive for actually being in country because of an old flame that he had met, you know, years earlier during the war. So there's that aspect of it. But the information theft, all of a sudden, there's a connection to Vietnam. I don't want to give away exactly what the information theft is, but it, again, it has to do with international trade and the U.S.-China competition. And basically then the book really gets involved in the, how do we find out what's going on with this information theft, how it's going to be used, and then how do we shut it down as far as the use of that information by the Chinese.
How much in a thriller, in whatever the subgenre is, right? How much in a thriller do you have to change your characters? How much growth do they have to have?
Wow. You've got to change, I guess for me, I've set it up. I mean, there are some changes, sometimes subtle, sometimes a lot. I mean, I had Aaron, who's the guy in Vietnam and the China factor. And when I had him in the China connection, I actually thought he was going to have a much greater role. At least that's what my thought was at the beginning. And all of a sudden, Kelly, the female character, took over in a way. But so did Mei Lin, who was not even on the radar screen when I first started writing. And then in the China connection, Mei Lin almost became the primary character. In this book, she's still there. She's very important. But she doesn't rise to the same level of importance as Kelly does in this one. So it's strange how, for me, I have the characters. I think I know what's going to happen to the characters. But then as the scenes develop, it's funny how characters can take over on you as the writer, at least for me personally.
It's a good thing.
It is a good thing because that means the character's communicating with you in a way that you didn't expect. And Jeff, being an author yourself, I don't know about you, but I start to talk with my wife about the characters as if they're real people. And we talk about what's going on with the character. And do we need to make this change? And so, yes, the characters change, reactions change, partly because of the way you've developed them. I mean, how independent are they, or how aggressive are they? You know, in Mei Lin's case, as a businesswoman, how does she deal with a lot of men that she has to interact with as a business person? As a CEO, being Chinese, does that work? And how aggressive can she be, or does she have to pull back? So there's a lot of things that go on in the characters itself, yeah.
When you say, like, characters do things you don't expect, do you remember the first time a character surprised you with something? And how weird does that feel as a writer?
It is the strangest thing when that does happen, because I would say of all the characters I've written about in the three novels, Mei Lin is the most surprising character. When I first put her into the China connection, she had no name, nothing. I just gave her a bit of a background. And as it developed, she just got stronger and stronger. And I would say that she may have been in that book anyway, the main character. But yeah, characters talk to you, and sometimes they don't necessarily talk to you. You just write a scene, and they've just taken over. And you don't really realize it till you go back and read it again, but it fits what you've done with that character as the story's developed.
When you bring characters from one book into another, does that make things easier for you, or does it bring new challenges?
Well, in this case, it was a little more of a challenge, because even though I thought I wanted to bring them in, the question was how I would do it. And what would their roles be this time? And this time, Kelly takes on a much stronger line in scenes and so on. And even though Maylin's in this one, she's not as prominent, shall I say, as she was in the China connection. And so I think Kelly just she becomes the main character in this one. And again, another surprise for me is dealing with female characters as a male writer. That becomes also another challenge that I'm conscious of as I'm writing the female characters, perhaps more so than when I'm writing about the male characters.
And other than your wife, do you have other female beta readers or people who...
Yes, actually. Chen, who's here today, she definitely, because of the last two books being China-related... it's been great having her as one of the beta readers, because she can give me input about either the culture or things like that, which is extremely important to give it something realistically. You know, am I out of bounds here writing about something or not? And also, as a male or Chinese male or female, am I staying within the lines or not? I think those things are helpful, especially when you're dealing with another culture, another country, and you've got... characters that are really integral to the story from those places.
Yeah, sensitivity readers can definitely make a book a lot stronger. And so you have a bunch of themes in this, and this property theft is like the plot, and you're talking about like generational issues and rate, and maybe guilt and association with the previous generation, right, and things. Well, what's like the primary theme to the book?
Well, for me, it's all about I have fun playing with the tension, the conflict between, you know, the U.S.-China thing that's been going on now for at least 30 years, but then all the possibilities that are under that umbrella or under that roof, you know, everything that could be something that puts people in this strange, interesting, and tense situations. And you can have a tense situation when you have a Chinese and American delegation sitting across the table from each other. It depends on what they're talking about. What are the pressure points? You know, what am I trying to get from them? And what are they trying to get from me? And how are we going to avoid committing ourselves to something we don't want to do? I mean, those are simple things. Sounds simple, but if you're sitting across the table, it's not so simple. And and then there are the things that don't happen across the table, but they're in the back rooms and things like that over drinks or whatever, because even though there's that formal part of the bilateral meeting, perhaps, there's also that social aspect. And what are people trying to do and get from you in that setting as well as in the more formal official setting? So there are all sorts of things that are really interesting. Probably there are other people that are even more creative than I am. They come up with, you know, thousands more.
So you did this in real life. So how careful do you have to be when you're kind of giving insight, using your inside knowledge, or at some point you have to think, is this so classified, or am I giving away like trade secrets, or, you know, how much did that inhibit your actual writing?
These days, not so much. I mean, I know it's there in the back of my mind, but I think I navigate that area pretty good, because while the actual issues might have at that time been confidential or secret, I mean, these days, a lot of these kinds of issues have been written about publicly in mainstream media for ages, because the problem is out there and it's been there. It's been written about. So I don't really think about it from a classified information perspective anymore. Yeah.
If you had one takeaway for readers from this book, like what is it you would want to impart to them? What is the one thing they should finish this book and know or think about?
Well, I think you have to think about the economics of the world as something interesting as opposed to something boring. I mean, because there's a lot of stuff that goes on here that we never really pay much attention to. And there are also a lot of people that work in this area doing interesting things on behalf of whether it's a company or a government and on behalf of the citizenry generally that we're not aware of. So that's just in general what it is, because I don't think it's a world that most people really are aware of. It's not really covered that much. But it's extremely interesting and fascinating for me.
Yeah, with some serious implications.
Absolutely.
So you wrote a lot of nonfiction before this.
Yes.
Tell us about the transition to fiction. Okay. In what ways is fiction different for you? Because it's incredibly different, right?
Yeah, the nonfiction was really professional stuff. So, you know, it's like doing a research paper in school. You have a lot of footnotes, facts are there. You're just putting things together. Fiction is completely a different animal, because you're creating the characters, the scenes, the places, whatever's going to happen. You've got to figure it out all for yourself. I did a nonfiction professional book in 2015. It's all fact-based. You look up stuff, and it can be really boring. Let's face it. If you don't, I mean, you're putting in a lot of footnotes and stuff like that. So it's really saying, I just need to put it in the right order. Right. Whereas with fiction, there is no order. You've got to come up with everything. You've got to create the characters, where they're from, what nationality they are, what ages they are, and what trouble are you going to put them in? And you've got to create that. And then how are they going to get out of trouble? And who's after them, if anybody? I mean, all of it comes. The fiction part is all of that you have to do yourself. I mean, you surround the edges with maybe some reality, but the guts. All the guts come from you, whereas with nonfiction, it can be tedious, it can be work, but it's all there. You just have to kind of collect the elements.
Did you find the freedom to be easier, or was it inhibiting in some ways because you have like infinite choices?
It can be harder because you do have all these choices for fiction. Once you decide on a nonfiction book, you know, you go to a publisher, you say, here's the project I want to write. And they go, okay, pretty much you know what the boundary is. You know this is the topic. You know that all the information that you're going to gather is going to be related to this topic. And maybe you even have a time period involved, right? With fiction, you decide all those things. And so from that perspective, you've got to decide where to whittle it down into a workable writing that you can deal with, but you have to come up with it all. You set your own boundaries. And to me, it's much harder.
Was that the most surprising thing when you switched to fiction, that it was harder? Did you anticipate it being a little easier?
I don't know what I thought. I know that the first time I tried to write Pendulum, I scrapped about 7 to 10 starts and would crumple up paper and throw it away, you know, and I just leave things for months. And then I think one day I saw a newspaper article and I thought, ah, maybe that's where the start is. So it's a lot harder. Even now, I mean, trying to think about how I'm going to, starting is always hard. Like right now, I'm on, I think, the third start for the next book. You know, you read through it, you go, I'm just not happy with this. And so I don't throw it away. I keep it all. I mean, it's all going to be there because I may fall back on it. But you go, it's not feeling right yet. So, yeah, fiction's much harder.
What did you do to teach yourself fiction? So it's a whole different tool set.
Well, one of the things, I did go and take a class at the Writers Center in Bethesda in Maryland, which was actually scary because you're in a room and when you exchange 10 or 15 pages with everybody else, and you go, my God, these people can write and I can't write anything compared to what I'm seeing here. So that part's pretty intimidating to me. The other thing is, I think what it helped, though, is when I came back a week later after everybody had shared mine, this one woman sitting next to me just stared at me as I was sitting down, and I didn't know what was wrong. And she said, I wasn't sure if I could keep flipping the pages. I was thrilled because I thought, well, at least there was some emotional reaction to what I wrote. So from that perspective, that was fine by me, whether it was positive, at least you had a reaction. So, yeah, it's harder. And I would say, I'm glad I never read books on how to write fiction, because I did read a couple of those afterwards. It scared me, and I would have said it would have discouraged me.
Do you do that now? I mean, do you do continuing education in this as you go, as you write?
I think for me, the continuing education is reading. I mean, I do take breaks and periods where I just want to read a few books, because I think reading what other people are writing helps me think about my writing. I mean, I've taken a couple classes. There are certain short exercises I like. But as far as continuing education, to me, it's reading.
So which authors have influenced you the most?
Wow. Well, the problem with that question is the authors I really like, I could never write like them. You know, like Ken Follett's books are absolutely fantastic. James Clavell, when he was still alive and wrote some incredible historical fiction. I can't write like that. I'll never even try to write like that. But then you read the Baldacci's and books like that, Ludlum books, things like that. And then you start to say, well, I want to avoid this and I want to avoid that, but I wouldn't mind being able to write like this or that. So it's really an interesting, once you've written a couple books, the way you read is also different, I think.
Do you find that it makes it harder for you to enjoy reading if you start analyzing as a writer?
It can. I mean, but it doesn't happen very often. There's only been one author's books I decided I'm not going to read anymore. And part of that is really the way he was doing female characters. I felt like, I don't think he knows how to write female characters. So I thought, I just do away with that author. But generally speaking, I just try to read to enjoy it when I take my break and say, I just want to have the next 6 months and read several books.
So I mentioned in your bio about your interrogation classes. Tell yeah. how did your military experience, I mean, we know how the property theft has influenced your work, right? But how did that military experience affect the way you write characters or the way you think of plot?
Well, that one, I did rely on that more for my first novel, which the copy's not here, The Pendulum Over the Pacific, which is based in Japan. But in that book, the main character, certainly I relied on that background quite a bit. And again, it goes back to a U.S.-Japan economic tension storyline. And so that character certainly had more of a, he had a military background and so on. And a few scenes in there where certainly I rely on that. I haven't used that too much in the last two books. There might have been a little bit of that in The China Connection. But the, you know, the interrogation thing is a little bit different. I don't write police kinds of stories, so it doesn't come into play as much. But I think there are opportunities in any scene. If you have a particular person that needs to answer questions and you have to get those answers, you can certainly rely on certain tactics or whatever. Could be interesting.
Well, you mentioned like evoking some kind of emotional response, whether positive or negative from people. And when you're interrogating, you have to have a basis in psychology, right, to understand the way people think, the way they deceive, yeah. the way they act. Do you find that that helps you in character creation?
You know, it's hard for me to answer that. I don't know if, you know, sometimes when I'm thinking about this, I go, maybe I need to ask the people that have read the books, because when I'm writing, sometimes I'm not thinking about that, or it doesn't hit me until afterwards that I've done something like that. It's I guess once when you're writing, you're just thinking about the character you've already developed, and you're not sure how it comes across until you go back later on, and you're not sure that it was really there. Maybe it was subconsciously. I think that's, if I'm really into a writing session, I'm just writing and it just flows. So I don't know if some of that happens just subconsciously, yeah.
So that flow is something everyone tries to achieve, right? So that perfect concentration, you're in the moment, you're in the characters' heads. Do you actually enjoy the process of writing? I'm always curious because I get it's about a 50-50 split on this question.
I do, because I don't get into an intricate outline before I start writing. I do a lot of research. Once I know where I want to go, I have a lot of stuff I look up. But I don't say, here's a strict outline I go with, which works for me in the sense that surprises happen while I write. Characters do things that I didn't expect. And so from that perspective, I enjoy it because there are things that happen that even I, as the author, hadn't planned on. I enjoy it from that perspective because, you know, at the end of the day, if something's happened or a scene or whatever, sometimes I go, I shouldn't be surprised, but I am, which makes it fun, you know, because I don't know everything about each character, and I don't know everything they're going to get into to cause a problem and to get them out. And it's that part, that's what makes it fun for me. It's a challenge, but it's fun.
So when you're a discovery writer and you're allowing things to just sort of unfold and happen, you're both a writer and a reader at that point, right? Because in some ways you're observing the story as it's unfolding before you. What is it about that, about story and unfolding and surprises to you that is fun for you and fun for your readers and seems to be fun for most people?
I think it's the unpredictability. That's the fun part, because I can be in the middle of a scene and let's say I have to, for some reason, I walk away for 2 minutes and I come back to it and all of a sudden something pops up that I hadn't even thought about. And it just turns in a direction that I hadn't anticipated. And probably the biggest thing that happened for me in the China Factor, this last book, was the ending. It ended in a way that I had no idea it was going to end like that. I mean, I didn't have an ending in mind, but when I wrote this one sentence, I realized that was the end. But it came as a bit of a shock to me, even though I'm the one in charge of the writing. But it did. It's strange how that happens for me.
How important are twists and surprises in your novel? And do you do them throughout, or you know, in each chapter, or are you just looking for a couple of main turning points, or what? How do you approach that?
They usually come, well, some chapters I have in mind, okay, next writing session, this is what I'm going to do. And it can go as I thought it was going to go. I can start another chapter and all of a sudden I think it's going to go this way. But because of a sentence or a paragraph I might have written, it causes me to go in a direction I hadn't expected. So it's again, because of a lack of that detailed outline, those surprises can come almost any time sometimes. I mean, there are scenes, yes, I know it's going to go this way. And then the next scene can be completely different with some surprises that I wasn't expecting to have happen because of a paragraph or a sentence I write. It's just the way it is for me.
Do you write every day?
When I actually get involved, like the China Factor, I wrote, I would say, almost every day. And that was the quickest I've written a manuscript. Now it's still 5 months, but That's the fastest I've written a manuscript. Yeah.
What was your first memory of wanting to do this? Because it's not easy. It's a tough business.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the good thing is I don't have to worry about making a living and paying bills off of this, because that'll never happen. But I would say that something I read probably in high school made me think someday, you know, I don't know when that day is going to be, I would like to sit down and try to write a novel. But that didn't happen for decades.
Do you remember that or that work or what it was?
It's actually for, you know, most of the folks here, or a number of the folks here, probably close to my age. And there was an old Western based on a book. And if you've seen Shane, the movie, the Western Shane, I read the book in high school, and there was one particular sentence that just stuck with me. And I thought, well, that's also something that's kind of good to live by anyway. And it just made me think someday maybe I'd like to at least try to write a novel. But yeah, it's really all about, you don't have to keep following and doing what other people do. You can create your own path and do what you want to do, and, you know, and just go out there and give it a try.
That story of like the stranger going town to town, you know, the gunslinger, it's in a lot of different cultures, right? Do you remember the line specifically?
I don't remember the specific line. I mean, gosh, that's been, what year would that have been, around, oh my God, 56 years ago or something. So no, I don't remember the line. But I remember the book. That was the book, though. Yeah.
So when you write, do you write to a page count or a word count?
Not really. I like to think that, okay, there is this, I'd like to pick out a couple scenes I want to try to write today. And then if it keeps me going, I just keep going. So it's not so much a page count or word count, although very important. But it's more a scene, you know, how's that scene going to develop, and can I work through the whole scene in one sitting? I think that for me is probably more important.
I've spoken to some writers who will end in the middle of the sentence, or they'll end right before the end of the scene so they know where they're starting the next day. Do you do that, or do you come to a conclusion, you finish the scene, you're ready for the next scene?
I would prefer to finish the scene and not stop, because it's just easier for me that way. I wouldn't want to stop before the scene's over. I just go through the scene, and if it takes me, you know, 3 hours to write it, I'll just stay there or nonstop or however long it takes. But I don't worry so much about the page count or the word count. I'll worry about that later. It's more important for me to get through the scene. Yeah.
Can you write anywhere, or do you have to write in your office at a certain time of day?
Usually today, these days, I mean, I just write at the dining room table at the condo most of the time. Although when I finished The China Factor, I was on an airplane. I knew I was within 5 to 10 pages of the end. So we were on a cross-country flight. I figured I'm going to be on a plane for 5 hours, so I might as well pull out the laptop. And I wrote the last sentence on the plane. Then I had to keep going back thinking, is that really the end? And yeah, I didn't. The mistake I made there, I will admit, that I probably should have kept going to see what the beginning of the next one was. That was the mistake I made there. Yes, that was the end of this one, but I should have said, okay, how am I starting the next one right then? That's what I should have done.
When you write in public like that, have you ever had people reading over your shoulder or taking an interest in what you're doing?
Well, the good thing is that, you know, when you're on an airplane, it's real hard for other people to, and my wife is sitting there right next to me, so there's nobody else around, so it's pretty easy. Although I took a picture of the screen one day last year when I was traveling, and I sent it to, I may have been put on Facebook page, and somebody I know tried to read what was on there. He wrote back and said, I couldn't make it out. I was trying to read it, but I couldn't make it out. But that's it.
Do you listen to music?
Oh, well, yes. Definitely listen to music when I'm on the treadmill, but that does not preclude my brain from thinking about the books or what might pop into my head. But it's interesting. You know, your brain can do more than one thing at a time.
Have you ever tried dictating since you're thinking of like on a treadmill?
No, never tried dictating. It's almost like with all the technology today, dictating seems to be something from the past that people don't. I don't do anyway. I stopped doing that a long time ago.
Well, you can do it on your phone and it goes straight to text. It's an efficiency hack.
I hadn't thought about that.
Did you use any, what do you like writing? What do you write in? You write in Word or Scrivener?
I write in Word right now, yeah. And then it's, well, I'm just so used to it at this point. Yeah. So it's easy.
So you I'm blanking on the name of your publisher for this.
It's Joshua Tree Publishing.
Joshua Tree, yeah. That's right. So, you have a lot of options, you know, in 2025, right, to publish.
Yeah.
Did you go back and forth between, like self-publishing or hybrid or traditional or, you know, there's big presses and going through an agent? And how did you land on this press?
The agent thing I found, this is years ago, and, you know, you could instead of focusing on your book, you can waste a lot of time trying to find an agent. And so I started looking for an agent, a publisher, when I did my book with the Vietnam veterans. So in 2016, I did want a publisher rather than self-publish. And that's when I reached out to Joshua Tree Publishing in Chicago. And that led to an extremely long telephone conversation with the publisher. And so he published that book, and then he's published the others since then. So we've had that relationship for, well, since 2016, 2017.
And do they help you with marketing?
A little bit. I would say these days, you know, it's like I think the authors seem to be the ones that are more responsible, shall we say, for marketing more than it, because some of the small independent publishers don't have that much of a budget if they've got 15, 20 authors or books out there. You know, the budget is so small. That as the author, you're almost wholly responsible for the marketing with social media and so on these days. And by the way, that's why I want to thank you for having me today to do the podcast. So thank you very much, Jeff.
No, it's my pleasure. What was the most surprising thing about the business side of writing? I mean, have you done much marketing with it, or have you found things more difficult or easier or more enjoyable than maybe you thought?
I won't say enjoyable is probably not a word for when it comes to marketing. You spend a lot of time writing. You hope that people will like, the few people that buy the books will like it. I have to say, you know, you rely on one, your social media activity, but then the people that do read your books, if they like it, if they share the information, so on. I have a couple people here today. There is one guy that probably is my unofficial PR guy, and I've never met him face-to-face. He's a Scottish guy, and he sails on a cruise line that I've been on, and he posts more, yes, Peter, somebody who knows him, he puts up so many things for me, violates all the rules of that Facebook page to do that, and I'm grateful to him because he'll post pictures of the covers of books and tell people to get the book and whatever. So he's been great. Now, I've never met the guy face to face.
Do you get any of the like the metadata from your publisher, or do they share sales with you?
They do, yeah.
To help you guide what you're doing with marketing.
Not so much. It's I reach out and try to get the information, and sometimes though I when you look at all the book sales websites and so on, or where the activity is, I frankly don't know that what I see captures everything. I have no idea. Because that's in his bailiwick. And, you know, I tend to say, okay, I'll let him deal with that and I'll deal with the writing part of it. I probably should be more involved in it. But you know, there's a point for me where I said, I will just try to write. And I probably should be more into the marketing side, but I'm not as much as I probably should be.
I'm going to go to questions in just a second, but I just wanted to ask you, you know, the whole writing thing is so magical in a lot of ways, because you're writing something that's coming out of your mind, right? And then each reader has a different experience with it, and they are seeing a different movie in their head.
Exactly.
By the way, you write very visually, I think. Do you see that when you're writing? Do you see it as playing out visually?
I have. Well, you know, I put something on a piece of paper. I said, whatever you write, what's the movie look like? And that's to tell me in my own brain as I'm writing, what are the scenes that I see? Because I think if people, as they read it, if they don't see those things, it's not going to be as enjoyable as a reader. I think they have to see the picture. Yeah.
So the one question I ask all the authors is just, where do you think story comes from? Because it is kind of a magical process.
Where does story come from? Boy, I did not expect that question. I think it's just... my mind is for me, it's just a jumbled, you know, pile of stuff that I just try to start putting together. You know, you've got a bunch of different things, and all of a sudden, I'm trying to figure out how do these things, whatever they are in front of me, how can they come together? The other way I think about it as well, if I have a house with all these rooms, is there something in the closet that I should let out, or that's up in the attic or in the basement? I mean, you know, each room has something different in it, and can I use that stuff and put it all together?
Yeah, that's a great way of looking at it. Okay, I'm going to come for questions. If anybody has anything, I'm going to ask you to use the microphone so it comes out on the video. Do you have any questions over here?
So, Tim, I've been enjoying all of your books, very visual, and I really appreciate learning from your books. I'm curious, in the China Factor, how did you know it was the end?
I didn't, actually. I mean, well, let's put it this way. I didn't plan on the end to be the end. I think that I knew I was close, but when I wrote that last paragraph and that last sentence, I just stopped typing. And for some reason, when I reread that unexpected end, I said, well, that's the end. And I think that that's happened, actually, with the three novels, that's happened each time. My ends don't end the way I ever think they're going to end. Let's just put it that way. But in this one, it was kind of a surprise because I thought I'd be writing a few more pages, but it just seemed right once I wrote it to stop right there. Don't touch it. Luckily for me, my number one editor at home agreed.
Other questions?
Jenny, nice
Hi,
to see
Tim.
You.
Good How to are see you? You. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
So I guess a question off of that is, it seems to me that there are lots of choices that you make along the way. And, you know, there's a lot of decision paralysis that plagues people. So how do you know that how do you make those choices along the way? Know that that's the right path. Do you second guess maybe some of these choices? So that really goes to along the way, yeah. Are you confident in how the storyline is going, how are characters develop, and how do you know when you're done with that?
There's a lot of, well, that's why you end up editing things, because, yeah, you're second-guessing quite a bit here and there. I think it's the second-guessing sometimes is, do I need another character in this room or in this scene? Is the character that I have, whatever I have them doing, is it appropriate for what I've done with that character building up to that point? That's another thing. Because, again, my editor points these things out to me. Nope, you shouldn't have this person doing X because they don't have the background or you haven't set them up, right? It just pops out of thin air and there's no justification for them doing something. There's quite a bit. I mean, in each scene, there are all those choices you have to make, and then you have to decide, well, is what I'm having a character do or whatever happens appropriate for what I've done already? And there's a lot of that goes on. So there's a constant thing going. I mean, I had, there's one scene in the China Connection, the prior novel, I had to literally go back and rewrite a whole section because I changed what the one character did. The impact was completely different based on what I originally wrote versus what I went back and changed it to. So, and then that helped me later in the book when I got to a totally different scene, like 100 pages later. So yeah, there's a constant thinking, have I done something somewhere that causes this to happen or I have to go back and change? And it's just the natural part of the process.
Other questions?
Well, hi, Tim.
Hey, John.
In your original book, The China Connection,
yeah.
Have you had anybody in China that you aware of read it? And if so, is their reaction to it different to Westerners' reaction to it?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, the other thing I would think too is, you know, I think no matter how good, because a lot of the Chinese government folks I've met over the years, their English is extremely great. I mean, just fine. But what I also find is a lot of people who are maybe good in a foreign language tend not to read a whole book in a foreign language. But yeah, I haven't run into anybody like that. I'm glad, too, that I haven't. That could be a trouble. I do worry about that, by the way. No more trips to China.
I'm so glad to have been here today to hear this interview because it has been an extraordinary experience for me. And so I must ask you this question, Tim, since we've known each other for many years. What's next, and what do you hope to never leave the earth without first having done?
Ooh. Well, what's next is I'm hoping that I can put together some pages to carry on with a couple of the characters that I have. But what haven't I done? It's like, gosh. I'm looking at Elaine and John because I've sailed for 4.5 months with those two a couple of years ago. I think it's really just being able to spend time with my wife.
Other questions? All right. Well, I have two requests for everybody here. Tim's got books up here for sale. He's got the last two titles. So you could be signing and selling, right? If you would just go on to Amazon and give them a 5-star review, it makes a really big deal. If you don't have reviews, sometimes people don't take a chance on you. So just, it takes like 15 seconds. And also, if you like what we're doing with our literary salon and our food here at Elaine's, please rate us on Google or Open Table or wherever else you could do that. It means a lot to us and helps keep us in business. So Tim, this has been really wonderful. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. It's good to have you here.
Jeff, thank you so much. Appreciate it very much. Thank you.